Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade
competition. It's 2018 on Legal Face Off. Welcome to it on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here for another year of hard-hitting talk. It's Rich Lankoff.
One more year.
And Tina Martini. I've heard we've got until 2020.
How are we still on the air?
To make it big. Yes, your mic is on, by the way.
It is not.
Yes, it is.
Then
yes.
Then there's something wrong with my headphones.
That's a good way to start the new year. Happy New Year. Hopefully you enjoyed. Hopefully Santa came down your chimney, or maybe you celebrated Hanukkah or Kwanzaa, whatever it may have been.
Festivus.
For the rest of us.
That's right. Big show to get to, per usual. We'll talk about the governorship in Illinois. Daniel Biss will join us. Of course, we'll talk about Donald Trump. We've got professors, Illinois media, and also the legal grab bag at the end of the show. Do you have your resolutions all in order, by the way?
I've broken them already. Just by showing up.
All right. Well, here we go. Before anything else, we will welcome Daniel Biss, senator here in Illinois. He's running for governor in the upcoming election, and he joins us here on Legal Face Up.
Senator, thank you very much for joining us today. So why don't you tell us what made you decide to run for governor?
Well, I think this is a critical time in the state of Illinois. People are hurting. Bruce Browner has failed. Social service providers and schools and children are in trouble. And our fiscal condition just got worse and worse and worse. But this is on the heels of decade after decade of a broken political system that benefited the very wealthy and harmed ordinary people. It's time for us to have a middle-class governor who understands the life that ordinary people go through and builds the political movement needed to finally have a system that works for the rest of us. I see this as a unique moment to build that movement, and I see this as a unique time to fundamentally transform the state of Illinois so that we have fair taxes, so that we have fully funded schools in all of Illinois, not just in a few zip codes, so we have health care that we can all afford. And my background, yes, as a successful state legislator, enacting progressive laws for the last 7 years, but before that, as an organizer, empowering people across the state to improve their own lives, and before that, someone teaching mathematics, I think prepares me to be the person to lead that movement to finally build a state of Illinois where there's a level playing field for ordinary people and where the playing field is not tilted in the favor of the very, very wealthy.
Senator, can't talk about Illinois governor without talking about the Illinois speaker. Michael Madigan is the longest serving speaker in American political history. You sponsored legislation to limit the term of the Speaker of the House. You've talked about term limits. You are in favor of them for some people, but not others. Tell us about, number one, your relationship with Madigan, what it would look like as the chief executive of the state, and your feelings on term limits.
Well, listen, Mike Madigan's been there too long, and he's too powerful, and I think that's held the state of Illinois back. I think it's held the Democratic Party back. And so the question is, what do you do about it? I think what you need is a governor who is independent of Mike Madigan, who has a record of being able to stick up for what the people of Illinois need and for what's right, regardless of what Mike Madigan wants. I also think you need a governor who can work with everybody, Democrats and Republicans, including Mike Madigan, including everybody else. And that's what I'm going to be. I've been in the legislature for 7 years. I've been one of the most independent members of the Democratic Party, prepared to call out Mike Madigan when I thought it was the right thing to do, and also able to enact almost 90 bills into law to change the lives of ordinary people. In this race, we've got two really problematic choices. There's Bruce Browner, who has chosen to make Springfield a personal battlefield where he and Madigan fight with each other and the rest of us lose. Or on the other hand, you've got J.B. Pritzker, who's just Mike Madigan's guy. We don't need either one of those paths. We need someone independent, someone with their own base of political support, someone who does not have to do what Mike Madigan wants, but also someone who's willing to work with everybody. And that's the record that I've amassed in the legislature. Now, I think the term limits for legislative leaders are a good idea because I think that someone should not serve in that power over the whole state and amass more and more and more influence over the course of decades and still only be accountable to voters in their own district. I support term limits for the governor as well, because I think you need that kind of turnover at that form of high office.
So turning to the issues, and there seem to be a ton of them that the state is dealing with right now, in which you have actually explained your position on a myriad of them. What do you think are the most important issues to deal with at this juncture, and how do you plan on addressing them?
Well, first of all, we have a broken tax system that is written by the very rich for the very rich, leaves middle-class families and the working poor paying too much, and leaves our government dead flat broke. We've got to fix that with a fair tax system that finally asks millionaires and billionaires to pay their share. You know, Illinois is a pretty rough place to be a middle-class family. It's a great place to be a billionaire. We got to reverse that. So we need to have a fair tax system, and that means amending the Constitution so we can have a progressive income tax. It means having our property taxes finally brought into line with other places. And then we have to use that new working fair tax system to fund our schools properly. We have the most inequitable school funding of any state in the union. It is wrong. It's unfair. It punishes property taxpayers, and it certainly punishes children in poor communities. I'm the only person in this race with kids in public schools. I'm the only person in this race whose family's own life and success and ability to thrive relies on having a public school system across Illinois that works. And I'm the only person in this race who's going to finally tax billionaires fairly so we can fully fund our public schools.
Senator Biss, last question. Everyone talks about bipartisanship. That seems to be, you know, something that everyone strives for when they get elected to public office. Illinois is a mess in terms of the opposite, partisanship, it seems like. How would you remedy that if elected? And also, how would you deal with someone who constantly is attacking Illinois and specifically Chicago, the stable genius in the White House, Donald Trump?
Well, if only we could have nothing but stable geniuses in public office, then everything would be fine. Listen. Bipartisanship is something that people like, because what we ought to have is public officials who will work with everyone. And that's the record that I have amassed in the legislature. I'm a strong progressive, and I'm proud of it, and I stick to my values. And if there's someone on the other side of the aisle who I only agree with 5% of the time, well, guess what? We take that 5% of the time, and we work together, and we write bills together. We learn from each other. And that builds a foundation of trust that we can then use to tackle the trickier issues where we may agree. So we need that ability to simultaneously stick up for what you believe in and find that common ground with everyone. That's missing in politics right now, but it's the record that I've built in the legislature, and it's the record I'm going to bring to the governor's office. So we can have a legislature and a governor working together to tackle the very severe problems that we all know the state of Illinois is facing.
That is Senator Daniel Biss. He's running for governor here in Illinois. The website, danielbiss.com. Good luck, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, I look forward to it. Thanks so much.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNradio.com. You can find the show on iTunes, on Facebook, and always on Twitter as we go back to the state of Michigan. And welcome back Professor Brian Kalt. He's professor of law and the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at the Michigan State University College of Law. And his latest book, which is a couple years back, Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies. How fitting, Brian, we bring you in to talk about presidents and their enemies and President Trump. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Michael Wolff, in his book, Fire and Fury, that's gotten a ton of attention, alleges that 100% of the White House staff feels that Trump is incapable of holding office, regularly discusses the 25th Amendment as a means to remove President Trump from office. You've written extensively about this issue. The 25th Amendment, we all know, establishes procedures for filling a vacancy in the office of vice president, as well as responding to presidential disabilities. Why do you think that the 25th Amendment would not be used to remove President Trump from office?
Well, the biggest problem with the 25th Amendment, Section 4 in particular, is that while it covers a situation like the Wolff book alleges, it really is not suited for situations in which the president is up and around and lucid and able to communicate. It really is designed for and functions best in a situation where the president is missing or unconscious or something like that. When the president can respond, things can get messy very quickly.
Has the 25th Amendment ever been invoked in our country's history?
Section 4 has never been invoked. Section 3 allows the president to declare himself disabled, and that's been used a few times. Typically, presidents going under anesthesia for surgery, before they do that, they'll hand over power to the vice president. I think President Reagan did that a couple of times. President George W. Bush did that. But Section 4, where the president is not saying that, where the vice president and the cabinet are declaring that he's disabled, that has never been used other than on TV and movies.
So you need, correct me if I'm wrong, you need a majority of the cabinet to vote in favor of it, and then there's a procedure after that. Again, in this situation, the proponents of using it for this purpose are arguing that not just Michael Wolff's book, but many off-the-record conversations. I saw one commentator say that, you know, off-the-record, almost every Republican elected official feels the way Trump's staff allegedly feels, if you follow the book. But this would be, I think, to your point, a dramatic interpretation of this amendment, to go from invoking it when someone is unquestionably incapacitated because they're, you know, under anesthesia or undergoing surgery, to jump to using it because you think that the president is out of line by tweeting or by referencing a bigger nuclear button. It's a pretty dramatic leap, correct?
It is, although it is also the case that if the president is doing things in a way that represent a clear and present threat, the Section 4 does offer some recourse for that. The problem is that it just doesn't work very well, because the procedure is the vice president and a majority of the cabinet declare that the president is disabled. At that point, the vice president becomes acting president. The president can then say that he's not disabled, and if that happens, what's supposed to happen then is that the vice president and the cabinet have 4 days in which to redeclare that he's disabled, and during that time, the vice president stays in charge. If they redeclare it, then it goes to Congress. You need two-thirds in the House, two-thirds in the Senate to agree that the president should be displaced. But the president, first of all, is not removed from office at that point, and he can keep redeclaring that he's okay and keep forcing new votes. And because they need two-thirds in the House as well as in the Senate, that's more than you need for impeachment. So if there's the support in Congress to displace the president under these grounds, it would definitely be the case that there would be the votes to impeach and remove that way. And that would be permanent and much less disruptive. So again, unless it's an imminent danger, right, like there's he's about to nuke North Korea or something, this mechanism not only is messy with the president able to fire back But it's not necessary because impeachment is easier. I should also say that bit about the president not taking power back immediately, that he's got to wait the 4 days, that is clear from the legislative history of Section 4, but a lot of people, when they look at the text, they say, and I see this all the time, commentators saying, the president, if he says he's not disabled, takes power back immediately. That misunderstanding could be cataclysmic, because if the president is saying that he takes power back immediately and the vice president says, no, you didn't, you have two people claiming to be president at the same time, then maybe the president would start firing people on the cabinet who had said he was disabled. So you have two groups of people saying they're the cabinet. It would be a disaster.
Be fun, though. That would be a lot. That would be fun, though.
Sounds like a good reality TV show.
I'd sell some books, and from whatever, you know, nuclear bomb shelter I'm in, I could get my royalty check.
So you mentioned impeachment, and that's another topic that has been a recurring theme throughout Trump's relatively young administration. And you mentioned how the whole idea of the 25th Amendment interplays to a certain extent with impeachment. Can you maybe just comment a little bit more about, you know, I think we're talking about two things here that are pretty unlikely, at least based on what we've seen and heard. But would you like to comment a little bit more about the impeachment discussion?
Sure. So when they designed Section 4, they wanted it to be harder than impeachment. They didn't want this to be an end run around impeachment, because the idea is, if the president has got to go, the preferred way to do that is through impeachment, through this political process where the House votes and the Senate holds the trial. And a lot of times people say, oh, well, it's totally a political process. There are legal standards, right? It's only supposed to be for high crimes and misdemeanors. But legally, the bar for that is pretty low. That is, pretty much anything that you could characterize as official misconduct could count as an impeachable offense. And so the real limit on impeachment is the political will. Gerald Ford famously said that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House says it is, but really, I think the wisdom in that is that it's only what a majority of the House will say it is, and they are very reluctant to do that unless it is a much more extreme situation than this country has seen. I mean, we had Clinton, which probably was a mistake to impeach him, because that wasn't going to work. Nixon probably would have been impeached. You have to go back to Andrew Johnson in the 1860s. That was probably a mistake, too. They should have settled that in court. We really politically have a really high bar for using impeachment. On the other hand, once we reach that bar, it's a much more legitimate thing to do, right? Who should be able to get the president out in the middle of his term? Congress, the only nationally representative body we have.
That's Brian C. Call, professor of law and the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at MSU College of Law. Go Green. I know it was a tough game over the weekend, but you got to be feeling good about the Spartans this year, right?
I think, one loss, we're used to coming on strong in March and so on.
It doesn't matter in January. All that matters is that you're ready in March.
We're just warming up.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit listings at dlapiper.com.
Rolling right along on Legal Face-Off on WGN. Back to the phones we go, and our next guest is Professor Orly Lobel, who is the Don Weckstein Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the University of San Diego School of Law, and also the author of the book You Don't Own Me, which is how Mattel versus MGA Entertainment exposed Barbie's dark side. Great reviews from the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and she will also be at the Harvard Co-op Bookstore next Wednesday, and in Chicago signing at the Seminary Co-op on March 21st. Welcome, Professor.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Professor. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and what made you decide to write You Don't Own Me?
So I'm a law professor, and I study innovation and intellectual property. And a few years ago, I wrote a book that's called Talent Wants to Be Free. And I was really pleased to see that the arguments I made there that companies are over-controlling the ideas that their employees develop and the mobility that their employees have to compete with them after they leave their jobs was really, really well-received. I was invited to the White House to speak about the book, and there are a lot of policy reforms that came from that. But I wanted to tell this story in You Don't Own Me because it's just a fascinating story that brings everything to life.
Well, tell us about the story. Tell us about the Mattel versus MGA case. We've covered it on this show, but why don't you bring our listeners up to speed?
It's a really roller coaster, colorful story with a lot of interesting.
Who knew that Barbies could be so litigious, right? I mean, who knew that the world of toys can involve so much litigation?
Yeah, so the world of toys and the world of entertainment is as cutthroat as, you know, the financial markets and Silicon Valley. And the story really begins with an unlikely hero, a quiet, shy designer at Mattel who gets sort of bored and uninspired by designing a different dress every few months for Barbie. And he comes up with an idea of a different doll line that would be multi-ethnic, more reflective of our current times, more sassy, more trendy. And he leaves Mattel and sells this idea to a competitor. And from that, everything just becomes a huge war, a decade-long litigation battle between these two toy makers and a lot of other kind of counterclaims, and a lot of really crazy details come out in the litigation about economic espionage, about corporate ethics, about how different companies make decisions about their consumer strategies, about their marketing plans.
You mentioned in a recent interview that you did to discuss the book, you were talking about cognitive property and how it relates to the more traditional forms of intellectual property. And I happen to be an intellectual property lawyer, so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about it, because it sounds like it was a pretty important part of your analysis.
Right. So we have a lot of lively debates about drawing the right lines and patent law and copyright law. How do we define trade secrets, trademarks, so kind of the pillars of intellectual property. But I've been showing in my research, and I think, again, it comes alive in this case, that beyond what the statutes define, we have cognitive property. We have below the radar these controls that are made through contracts. So basically, in this case, and it's actually really representative of what we're seeing in all industries with just generic contracts that employees sign, we have these assignment clauses that say, regardless of what we know from patent law, regardless of something, if something is patentable or non-patentable, if it's copyrightable or non-copyrightable, if it's in a tangible form, if it's been reduced to practice or not, if it's completely abstract as an idea, which in an intellectual property, as we know as intellectual property lawyers, those cannot be patented. All of that will be owned by the company.
It's interesting, Professor, because your book, you know, I think it's a great case study of the nitty-gritty part of, you know, this world and also this litigation. But also, it also takes a big picture look at lots of different issues that are incredibly relevant. I mean, up to the minute, we're talking later today about the Time's Up movement and how part of their goals are to do away with non-disclosure agreements that are often used to silence victims. Part of what you talk about in the book is, you know, how this Barbie versus Bratz case affects so many different areas, including gender, including, you know, these kind of agreements. Can you touch on why this book is relevant in light of, you know, what's going on in the world today?
Absolutely. So it's actually the other side of the coin that employees are signing away not only their rights to leave employers and to use their creativity and ideas as they go throughout their career, but they're also signing away their ability to speak up against wrongdoing. And so it's, I think it's absolutely, as you say, NDAs are problematic from those two aspects. And in fact, Judge Kaczynski is one of the, again, the heroes, the very complex characters in the book. I sit down with him, and now, you know, he has resigned with the scandals that he's been involved with. And you can see in the book already some hints to kind of the future and what happens next. With, I describe his previous investigations on the porn that he held, and just his worldview. And you can kind of start thinking about how the connections between speech and what we have today in our various interactions in the market, in the private sector, in the public sector, how they're shaped.
Professor, how much did you have access to people from Mattel and MGA? What was their reaction? Were they trying to shut you down? What was their response to your book? Heard a lot. We've covered a lot about, you know, we'll be covering later today Michael Wolff's book and, you know, right, the president's reaction to that. What was these powerful people's reaction to your book?
Right. So, yeah, there's, of course, an irony where I describe how litigious Mattel is against anybody, not just competitors, but artists, musicians, critics. I was very fortunate. My publisher, Norton, cleared everything with a previous general counsel of The New Yorker. You know, I'm a storyteller and an author, but a researcher, and everything that I say in the book is backed up with a lot of research and the transcripts in the, you know, the public court hearings. But also, I did sit down with a lot of people from both sides. So turns out the attorneys are more likely to talk to you than the executives at first. But I did sit, I did talk to executives on both sides. It wasn't that easy with Mattel. It was easier with their competitors. But eventually I talked to people on both sides, and, you know, they had their perspectives to tell.
That is Professor Orly Lobel, professor of law at the University of San Diego School of Law. In the book, make sure you check it out, You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We wrap up our guest segments on Legal Face-Off with return guest, one of our favorites, political correspondent at WTTW's Chicago Tonight, the lovely Amanda Vinicky. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Amanda, yeah, I think this is the third year in a row we've had you on to talk about Illinois laws you need to know. So let's kick it right off with HB 40. Tell us about this new law.
Illinois has about 215, I believe it is, new laws in this new year. But the one that you've probably heard most about is this HB 40. Otherwise, it's taken on the moniker the abortion law. And this is taking on a lot of headlines for a lot of reasons. And first and foremost is that it earned Governor Bruce Rauner a primary and really a lot of disarray for his campaign as he seeks to hold on to the governor's office, being abandoned really by a lot of conservatives for having signed this into law. The bill itself does two things, one of which is not really taking front and center right now because it doesn't need to. That is, if on the federal level Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, this removes a trigger that had been in Illinois law that would have basically had Illinois follow the lead of the feds. Instead, whatever happens with Roe v. Wade, it says abortion can remain legal in the state of Illinois. Can get to all of that later. Again, not really necessary because it's not taking effect. But the other ramifications do right away, starting January 1st. Any state employee who is on Illinois government health insurance, and then also lower-income women who are on Medicaid, can have elective abortions paid for by the state. And so what you have, people who are, again, a lot of Republican, conservatives, anybody who is anti-choice says that that is, in other words, taxpayer-funded abortion. And so there is actually a lawsuit that they've filed to try and obviously didn't stop it from taking effect, but they're going forward and trying to say that this should not be Illinois law and that it is the greatest expansion of taxpayer-funded abortions at the state level.
So that's very interesting, and it'll be an interesting one to watch it play out. There, as you said, are 215 new laws that went into effect this year, and a couple more of them that are getting a lot of attention are the one that says that repeat gun offenders will go to prison longer, as well as the changing gender on birth certificates. Would you like to comment on those?
Yeah, sure. So the one that says repeat gun offenders, basically this is if you are caught with a gun illegally once, maybe go to prison, get in trouble with the law, but then it happens again and again and again. This is something that Chicago Police Superintendent Andy Johnson has said will really help to clamp down on Chicago violence and on crime. He says that, you know, these are the bad guys, lock them up longer. It's getting a lot of attention because that it actually goes against a separate goal that Rauner had set forth, and that is to try and lower Illinois' prison population. And so we will be watching to see, does this have any actual material effect on crime? The law does something else that isn't getting as much attention, and that is trying to reduce recidivism, and while you're giving people longer sentences, also try and, you know, incorporate that with anti-violence initiatives in prison and things like that. So that is one of those that is getting a lot of attention, obviously because of this horrific problem we have with gun crime in the city of Chicago. That other one, in terms of being able to change the gender on your birth certificate more easily, that is, so right now you need to, or previously to 2018, you would need to have actually had surgery, a sex change, in order to go and petition to have the gender that was printed when you were born changed on that very official document that you need for all sorts of government business. Now instead, there are, of course, therapies, hormone therapies and such that can accomplish that initiative. And so this is something that for the LGBTQ community was important, as this is, they say, they need in order to apply for jobs, maybe security clearance, what have you, to have the gender that they go by match what is on their birth certificate. And this will make it easier for that to happen.
Amanda, the animal lobby is stronger than ever in 2017 because we've got a variety of legislation dealing with animals. We've got, just like a court has to consider the well-being of a child during divorce proceedings, the court now should consider or is required to consider the well-being of a pet. In addition, we have elephants now are formally banned from circuses, a practice that animal rights activists have been protesting for decades. And then finally, we've got legislation dealing with the feral cat problem, which I know.
Yeah, be
nice when you're talking about that because I have two feral cats. So,
oh, I love cats personally. So, let's start with I think maybe that circus ban. And so, Illinois is the first state actually to have a ban on traveling elephant acts. So, it's not that you won't be able to see elephants if you go to Brookfield Lincoln Park Zoo, but if Ringling Brothers was still around, they could not bring elephants to Illinois. That's something actually that very popular circus, prior to its shutting down, had actually not had elephants in recent years regardless. But, you know, the thought being that these are very smart animals and some, and often not treated well when they are traveling acts, that they're not, you know, people who say, I want to be in the circus, obviously they're forced into it and it isn't healthy.
Those are the new laws in 2018. Thanks to Amanda Vinicky, political correspondent at WTTW's Chicago Tonight. I'm sure we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
It is my pleasure.
Seven topics on the legal grab bag, the first one of 2018 with Rich and Tina. My name is Sam. We'll start with Cook County e-filing. How exciting.
Fascinating way to start. Not as fascinating as one of the topics Tina has coming up.
Look out.
Get wish ready. I would have brought my confetti.
Nap time coming up on the tax.
Hey, watch it.
This is my...
version of the tax.
If there are any lawyers listening, I know there's a couple. It's important. Cook County has been long behind almost every other jurisdiction, even though it's the second largest clerk's system in the country. When you go to court, Sam, as you do frequently for your variety of legal issues, I know.
Yes.
You still have to use carbon paper, right? It's 2018.
Do you know what carbon paper is, Sam?
Yeah,
no.
You're too young. But you literally have to fill out a order and then use carbon paper for duplicates. I mean, it's so far behind the
isn't
times.
Is this an arts and crafts type deal, carbon
this is,
paper?
This is actually law.
Crepas?
This is law stuff.
Oh.
So long story short, there was a lawsuit brought by a new service in an effort to bring Cook County... Circuit Court Clerk Dorothy Brown into the 21st century and use e-filing. And right before the new year, she got an extension. So now Cook County will have to wait another 6 months to meet a deadline to make paper filings e-filing. In federal court, in many other jurisdictions, e-filing has been around for a long time. Obviously much more convenient, more efficient. Dorothy Brown has been very defensive in saying that she's innovated a lot. Yesterday, a federal judge ordered her to provide outlets with immediate access to some civil lawsuits. So this will happen hopefully quickly, but she's gone on record and said, basically, we're doing the best we can.
I think we should actually use Ditto as like a great way to segue from the carbon paper to e-filing. Do you remember what Dittos are, Sam?
Ditto means exactly, right?
Not the Ditto I'm talking about. The Ditto machine. We had those in
was that
Chicago.
Like a
it was like the it was like
cranky
the,
thing?
Yeah, remember that?
Vaguely.
It was like purplish blue ink.
Yeah, vaguely. But I mean, carbon paper, literally, if you walk across... you know, a couple blocks from here, you will see carbon paper being used in the court of the second largest court system in the country. So kind of nuts.
The more you know with the shooting
ding,
star.
Ding, ding, ding.
Fire and
that's
Fury.
That's one to grow on.
It is one to grow on.
It's all the craze right now. The new book from Michael Wolff, Inside the Trump White House. Of course, the president very upset. He says the book amounts to defamation, false light invasion of privacy, and an inducement of breach. So
that just rolls off your tongue, Sam.
Yeah,
by the way.
I was just going to
say. Pretty impressive use of some
and there's nothing
terms
left
there.
To be said.
Oh, well, let's move on to number three. No, I mean, is he going to get hammered for this book? Because, you know, freedom of press, you're allowed to write, but Trump is, of course, going to say anything negative is not true.
Of course he is.
I think I saw a stat where Trump has threatened something like 16 lawsuits before or since he became president and has actually gone through with two of them. So we've talked extensively, he loves lawsuits, he loves lawyers, thank God for that. But
and he loves Twitter.
Yeah, this is going, and the lawsuit's going nowhere, but sorry to step on the story.
No. So I think at this point you have to be hiding under a rock not to know what's been going on with Fire and Fury. Everyone started talking about this late last week. It's Michael Wolff's now very famous book, which is an account of Trump and his White House staff.
Number one bestseller, by the way.
Yes.
Already.
In a nanosecond. It took a nanosecond for that to be number one. And it details the 2016 campaign. And if you haven't been able to figure it out already, does not cast the Trump administration in a particularly favorable light. It includes detailed accounts and quotes from people such as former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon. So the book was actually originally scheduled to launch today, but the release date was moved up to last Friday because of an unprecedented demand. An excerpt from the book was released in New York Magazine back last week, along with some other media outlets that simultaneously released excerpts, which prompted a very significant and immediate reaction by the White House. Our favorite White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said the book is filled with, quote, false and misleading accounts. And the White House claimed that Bannon had, quote, lost his mind. Trump's lawyer sent an 11-page demand last Thursday claiming, as Sam said, that the book amounts to defamation, false light, invasion of privacy, and an inducement of breach of Bannon's agreement with the campaign. Over the weekend, as I'm sure you all saw, I think it was on Sunday, Bannon issued an apology claiming that the comments that he had made in the book that were believed to be about Donald Jr. were actually about Paul Manafort and not Don Jr., who he called a, quote, patriot and a good man. Michael Wolff was interviewed yesterday on MSNBC's Morning Joe, and he denied that Bannon had actually been talking about Paul Manafort. So in his demand, President Trump requested that Wolff and his publishing house, Henry Holt, cease and desist from further publication of the book. He demanded an apology and a complete retraction. Yesterday, the attorney for Henry Holt said that her client does not intend to cease publication, that there will be no apology and no retraction. She also said that if the president decides to pursue litigation, that all documents in his possession regarding the subject matter of the book would undoubtedly be relevant to the defense. So this is going to, I think, continue being a front and center story, and I think it's only going to get more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's like textbook Trump. It's prior restraint, right? I mean, prior restraint is an effort by the government to restrain the communication of some kind of, you know, art or publication, and it's expressly forbidden by the Constitution and, you know, sort of all we hold sacred as freedom-loving Americans. It's just not the American way to go for a president to be threatening a lawsuit against an author. I mean, he should have shut up. The best political move would have been to shut up and not give any more attention to this author if he didn't agree with it. I mean, these books are common. They come out in the first year of every presidency. By all accounts, Wolf did exaggerate. His access did exaggerate. He screwed up on some key facts. I just started reading the book a couple nights ago. I'm a little reluctant to finish it because I do believe that someone who can't get some basic facts right, like people's names and titles and spelling, that does probably raise some red flags. But the bottom line is, politically, Trump should have kept his mouth shut and not given more attention to it. But that's not how Trump acts. But from a legal perspective, his lawsuit's going nowhere. It's just typical Trump threatening stuff that he'll never follow through with.
We have an update on the farmer bro, Martin Shkreli.
Well, how could we Shkreli. Start? How could we start a new year without talking about the pharma bro?
It's either Shkreli or Cosby.
Well, now it's Shkreli. So the update is that on December 27th, former Canton Mutual Rosemont partner Evan Griebel was convicted of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to commit securities fraud in connection with his representation of Martin Shkreli, the pharma bro. Griebel acted as outside counsel to Shkreli's former company, Retrofin. A lawyer for Griebel stated that they were, quote, shocked by the verdict and intended to continue to fight for Griebel and his family. Specifically, Griebel was charged with assisting Shkreli in defrauding the company through a series of sham consulting agreements, and he was also accused of conspiring with Shkreli to exercise secret control over the company's shares belonging to several other shareholders. When he is sentenced, he faces up to 20 years in prison, and our favorite pharma bro is actually scheduled for, he's awaiting his sentencing, and that's scheduled for January 16, and he's currently in prison.
More Shkreli updates to follow.
Yes.
Do we have to?
Oh, come on. You love it, Sammy.
There's a new movement titled Time's Up, which has been launched. It combats sexual harassment in the workplace, and there are a lot of legal heavy hitters lining up behind it.
Yes. Tina Chen was chief of staff to former First Lady Michelle Obama. She has joined a very prominent litigator at the Paul Weiss Rifkin firm named Roberta Kaplan, who also started her own firm after she left Paul Weiss. They have begun this initiative, as you mentioned, called Time's Up. A lot of us heard about it for the first time at the Golden Globes on Sunday night. Oprah Winfrey, who will be president in 2020, mentioned the movement. Many of the celebrities who actually brought many activists with them were wearing black in a show of support for the movement. And the goal of this initiative is to partner with the National Women's Law Center to administer a legal defense fund, which will help subsidize the cost of lawyers and communications professionals representing individuals who are victims of sexual harassment or sexual abuse or sexual assault. So far, in the short time it's been around, the fund has raised more than $13 million from over 200 donors, including Jennifer Aniston, Meryl Streep, Shonda Rhimes, many others. We're going to try to get some of the leaders of this movement on our show. But again, this is all, as we've covered on our show and just a few minutes ago with our guest from University of San Diego, part of the continued movement to shine a light on sexual harassment, sexual abuse.
As promised, the big hitting story, tax bill possibly violating the Constitution.
Well, it is all about
two words that Sam loves, tax bill and Constitution.
Those are three words.
This episode has been one big constitutional law class. So I don't know about you, Rich, but my partners and I have been talking about this one a lot.
Yes.
You say that with such zeal.
Yes.
So I will keep this one quick because I don't want my co-host to be falling asleep on me. So last month, Congress passed the controversial tax bill, which, among other things, puts a $10,000 cap on state and local deductions for income and property taxes. This change has sparked a lot of controversy and upset among taxpayers and state and local leaders. And as a result, several governors of high tax states are considering a constitutional challenge to the cap, including New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, New Jersey Governor Philip Murphy, and California Governor Jerry Brown. Interestingly, or at least to me, it's interesting, in a State of the State address, Cuomo said that this cap is an effort to steal from the blue states to pay for the red states, and that it amounts to double taxation and violates states' rights and the principle of equal protection and is therefore unconstitutional. Other arguments that have been presented include that the cap interferes with states' rights under the 10th and 16th Amendments, as well as the Due Process Clause. So the Trump administration, as they usually do, has caught wind of this and has stated that they plan to block any efforts to try to hinder or sidestep the cap. So
Going nowhere.
I think you're absolutely right.
I think the bottom line is this is political. I mean, it's a reaction from the Democrats to what Trump is touting as his signature achievement in his first year and a half in office. You know, typically Congress has broad power to impose taxes. So I think any attempts by the states to interfere with that will be quickly disposed of by the courts.
That's it?
That's all we got. Sam, wake up.
That's all we got.
Wake up, little Sammy.
All right. How do I transition from tax bills to a shooter in Colorado? I don't know.
Well, the shooter,
legal, there's a legal angle here.
There is a legal angle.
A law school angle, right?
There is a law school angle. So a 37-year-old Iraq war veteran and graduate of University of Wyoming Law School was shot and killed on New Year's Eve when he opened fire and fatally shot a sheriff's deputy in suburban Denver. He happened to live stream the event, and he also wounded four other officers and two bystanders. This is a tragic ending to a story that actually began a couple of months ago when the shooter began to act suspiciously, including posting numerous times on Facebook targeting various University of Wyoming professors and talking about his desire to commit violent acts against them. Campus police decided to increase security at the school, and the school actually warned the students in an email on November 6th to be on the lookout for the suspect. The shooter, his name is Matthew Ryle. had been identified as a troubled student during his tenure at the law school. He had graduated in 2010 and became a licensed attorney in Wyoming in 2011. He actually practiced at a firm, opened his own shop, and then he voluntarily withdrew from the bar in 2016. He has an unfortunate history of mental illness. Dating back to 2009 and 2010, he had been in a veteran's mental health ward after serving in the Iraq War. And he was treated for a psychotic episode and then subsequently escaped. He was found and returned to the facility and was placed on a 72-hour mental hold. So I guess the good news is here, if there is any, was that the school caught wind of his Facebook activities and tried to warn the students, but an unfortunate and very tragic end. So,
yeah, I mean, it sort of brings to mind the topic we had maybe a show or two ago about the responsibility of schools. Mm-hmm. When faced with some information that someone might be dangerous, or I think in that segment we talked about the responsibility of schools to avoid bullying and deal with elements of bullying. But yeah, I mean, you could argue that University of Wyoming College of Law had some notice of his behavior. I mean, there was this email that they said to be on the lookout for him. They had, as you mentioned, information about suspicious behavior. I think ultimately, you know, obviously the school can't govern people's behavior. This guy is just, you know, unfortunately a wacko.
Well, and they increased security too, which, yeah. I think, you know, query whether other schools would have done the same thing, but they clearly took it very seriously.
Yeah, tough situation.
Former Arizona football coach and former Michigan football coach Rich Rodriguez. His attorneys are prepping to sue an accuser for attempted extortion.
Yeah, Melissa Williamson, or Wilhelmson, has accused Rich Rodriguez of sexual harassment. She filed a $7.5 million claim, allegedly, after he refused to pay. He, of course, has come out now and said that he's denied the accusations of sexual harassment. And he has said that she's doing this for money. And as you mentioned, he has now filed a lawsuit against her. Notably, he admitted to the affair. He said, "I'm not a perfect man, but the claims by my former assistant are simply not true. Her demands for a financial settlement are outrageous." But in Arizona, her filing this claim is the first step to filing a lawsuit, so we could expect that there will be competing lawsuits about this. But as you mentioned, the school fired him fairly quickly. Rich Rod, that's the end of his career, we think?
I would think
former
so.
Former Michigan coach, former, West Virginia?
He's been around the block.
Fairly successful career. Didn't do so well with his dream job in Michigan.
Nope.
But, probably the end of his career.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So that does it for the
feelings on the game last night.
Oh, I loved it. I love it.
By the way,
your
referee,
buddy.
Yeah, refereed by noted plaintiff's lawyer Dan Capron. He was the main referee last night, and he'll be on our show hopefully next time, telling us all about his experience going from a plaintiff's lawyer to a ref. He's obviously not a ref full time; he does both, but. Yeah, he had a good time with the second coin flip yesterday.
Yeah, they missed a lot of calls, too, that screwed Jordan.
Well, you'll have to press him on that when we get him on.
Seriously, they blew that bad.
Yeah, there was a couple rough calls. But
the face mask, the offsides. What's with the lawyers and judges being officials? Isn't the guy that wears it?
Ed Hockley, right?
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
The guy
Ed
who
Hockley.
Wears, he's also, probably an extra large and he wears a medium.
Yeah.
So when he does like offsides, like the muscles just bulge out of the shirt.
Gun show with Hockley.
These guys work 6 days a week, and then they on Sundays they're officials.
Yeah, yeah. It's a what better way to prepare for the fight on the field is fighting off the field. But
I think this is what Rich wants to do secretly.
Oh, for sure.
No, he wants to be a hockey ref or a mascot.
Yeah, put on the foil.
Oh, I want to see you be a mascot.
We need a legal face-off mascot.
We do.
So Alabama. What, they got six now under Saban?
Five under Saban. He also had one at LSU.
Enough already.
5 and 9 years.
Sick of Saban.
5 and 9 years.
That guy launched it. I thought they were done after that sack. Like, I was literally texting someone that this kid was overmatched, and then he launches that, 50, 60 yard, just perfect pass. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I was rooting for Georgia. So, yeah.
So Sammy, are you going to comment on the new Bears coach?
I like him. I like him.
Matt Nagy?
He's bald. He looks like
yeah,
Rich.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck. In his 30s, like Rich.
Oh, yeah.
39. High nine. He's creative. He's personable. He's exciting. He's going to do things.
Is he the new Sean McVay? That's the question.
Old man River John Fox going to do. That's the plan.
Yeah.
He is going to do a lot of run-pass option. He's good for this quarterback. He's going to utilize Mitch Trubisky, and that's the plan. And go figure. This is a four-year deal for Nagy. Pace has four more years. Trubisky has four more years.
Yeah,
this so this will either sink or swim. This is these three guys in a boat for the next 4 years.
They draft a receiver or they go line or what do you think? They
better
need a receiver
something.
Desperately.
I think maybe pay one in free agency.
Yeah. All right.
All right. By the way, the premiere of 85. What's
85
the
premiere? Well, the premiere, official premiere, was at the Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio last week. But the
one night only.
It hits theaters on January 29th. Like 250 theaters across the country. Tina's rented out a whole theater.
Yes, in Evanston.
Really? Did you really? I'll go.
But yeah, tickets are available right now on Fandango or on Fathom Events. There'll be a... we taped the panel we had at the Hall of Fame, so that'll be in advance of the show. And yeah, go see it. Go check it out.
Welcome to 2018. It's Legal Face-Off for Rich and Tina. My name is Sam. Thanks to Craig Collins, and big thanks to all of our guests. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face-Off.